Have you seen, by chance, seen the UK show Bodyguard?
I sure have.
Steven Spielberg presents Back to the Future, a Robert Zemeckis film. Marty leads an ordinary life.
No McFly ever amounted to anything in the history of Hill Valley.
Well, history is going to change.
And 1985 is not his year. But Dr. Brown is about to change all that.
Are you telling me that you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
He's sending Marty 30 years back in time.
So today we're absolutely delighted to have Evelyn Al-Sultani with us, who's an associate professor in the Department of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California in LA. She's a leading scholar of contemporary Arab and Muslim American cultural politics and popular culture. And we draw heavily on Evelyn Al-Sultani's work in our RIS test workshop. Hello, Evelyn.
Hi, Sadia. Hi, Shah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on our podcast. Can I just say, we were absolutely chuffed to bits when you emailed and you said, yes, you'd love to be on.
Well, the feelings are mutual. I'm over the moon with what the two of you are doing.
Oh, thank you. Would you like to share with us a little bit about your journey and how you've got to your current role?
Yes. So I started a new position at the University of Southern California in January. So I'm only 4 months in.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. And I'm in the Department of American Studies and Ethnicity. And before then, I was at the University of Michigan for 14 years. So I had a long stint there. And I was also in the American Studies Department at the University of Michigan. And while I was there, I co-founded an Arab and Muslim American Studies program within the department. So in the department, we have African American Studies, Native American Studies, Asian American Studies, Latino Studies. And my colleague Nadine Naber and I really wanted to see conversations about Arabs and Muslims in the U.S. within the context of ethnic studies and racial politics. So we started this very special little program, and it was very hard for me to leave it. But this other opportunity came up here in California, and it's been interesting to be closer to Hollywood since these are the kinds of things that I study.
Was that a difficult task to set up that new school, that new field of study? Was that a difficult thing, or was it a hard sell, or was it quite easy for the school to adopt?
Within my department, it was easy. So my colleagues very much saw the need. And I've noticed over time that 9/11 was really a shifting moment in terms of people paying attention. So Nadine Naber and I both were working on questions of Arab American racialization before 9/11, but no one really cared. And then after 9/11, there seemed to be more attention and awareness of questions of racialization around Muslims and Arabs. And so there was a lot of support within my department. It was a little bit more challenging and took a lot of time to get the university administration on board. So it took maybe 9 years of being an unofficial program, and then eventually it became official.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's great that you guys have the patience and the resilience, because it's such an important topic, as you know. How did the students respond to this new course?
It was incredible, because in Michigan, there's a very large Arab and Muslim student population. And I actually went to Michigan as an undergrad, and I remember when I was there that being in the university was such an important moment to learn about myself and my background and my identity. And if you wanted to learn about Muslims, you took Islam 101. If you wanted to learn about Arabs, you did Middle East studies. Mm-hmm. But I really longed to learn about my identity in the U.S. context. And so when the program first started, there was, and there still is, a lot of effort to just let students know, because they don't know to go to American Studies to find this. But once they find it, they're just so drawn to it and appreciative of it. And it really resonates with them. So there seemed to be a really special synergy in creating the program and reaching particular students. We have all kinds of students in the program, but those who are of the identities have a particularly special relationship to it.
I'd love to be on that program.
Same.
Me too. I'd love to be a student in that program.
Evelyn, you mentioned identity. I remember watching your TEDx talk, Untapped Stereotypes, and you talked about your Iraqi and Colombian identities and how your parents would have to respond in a certain way when asked about, when asked that age-old question that was people who are often othered get asked, where are you from? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So I was born and raised in New York. And throughout my life, I think the most common question I have been asked is, where are you from, or where are you from? And my parents got that all the time. I mean, in my case, I have an American accent. They do not. So my father was from Iraq, Shia Muslim from Iraq. And my birth mother was from Cuba and Catholic. She passed away when I was 6 years old. And then my stepmother raised me from when I was six onwards. And she's Colombian and Catholic. And so growing up, people would ask, where are you from? And my father would say, he wouldn't say Iraq, he would say, I'm from Turkey.
Oh, wow.
As to him, he thought that was a more acceptable place to be from, or maybe he'd get less questions. And my stepmother, instead of saying Colombia, because she didn't want to hear all the questions about drug dealing, she would say she was from Spain. And so as a young girl, 6, 7, 8 years old, I just wondered, why are they lying? Why are my parents lying about this? And then eventually I started seeing that when they did say Iraq and Colombia, they would get these questions about, how do you make your money? These assumptions about terrorism, these assumptions about cocaine. And so I think that experience was very formative to me. And while all that was happening, of course, my brother and I were watching Indiana Jones and Back to the Future and Romancing the Stone and all these movies that we delighted in. Mm. And later in life, I realized this is what people are watching. And of course, it's shaping the experiences, the daily lived experiences of my parents and of so many other people.
So interesting that way that you've put that, where are you from or where are you from? We get that same here, because I'm from North Manchester. And people say, where are you from? That's why I'm from North Manchester. But as a brown guy with a beard, it's like, yeah, but where are you from? Again, you're right. I'm actually from, specifically, I'm from Crumpsall in North Manchester. Just to kind of...
it gets really awkward here in the UK. And there's a really, really good BBC Three clip, the Where Are You From game, where a girl is at an interview for a job. And the white male interviewer asks her at the end of the interview, oh, okay, so finally, where are you from? And then she basically evades the question and she keeps giving herself loads of points to see how, bonus points to see how far she can take it. So I'm going to send you that video, Evelyn, because I think you'll find it absolutely hilarious. It's a brilliant video.
I'd love to see it.
Yeah, and another thing you said there is that films that we grew up with and we delight in, like as you said, films that we hold very close to our hearts as just, you know, in our formative years. I remember Back to the Future, which is, you know, a classic 80s film. And as an 80s child, you know, you love that film. You remember the hoverboards, you remember Marty McFly, but then all of a sudden you look back and you see Libyan terrorists.
Right.
It's craziness. And it's funny how you internalize it. It's only when you go back with a critical eye and you think, oh, that's where people get that view of Muslims from. And that's where Sadia and I have discussed so many times the power of the arts and film and TV specifically.
Yes, and it's not just, this is something Melanie McAllister says in her book, Epic Encounters, that it's not about one movie. So it's not like, oh, Back to the Future bad, but Back to the Future alongside hundreds of other movies repeating the same message over and over again is what makes it so powerful.
It's true. It's just incessant. It's relentless. It's relentless. And then you think it's no wonder that people hold these racial stereotypes, because even people within Muslim communities start actually internalizing some of these stereotypes and start using the same discourses, which is often I find a big worry for me. You briefly alluded at the beginning to pre-9/11 and post-9/11. Can you talk us through how you think, in terms of the research you've done and the work that you've written, how you think Muslim representation in the media has changed over time?
Yes. So I wrote a book called Arabs and Muslims in the Media, Race and Representation After 9/11. It was published in 2012, but I started the research for it immediately after 9/11. And what inspired me to write the book was that I was watching television like many other people were after 9/11, trying to make sense of what had happened. And I was surprised to see an increase in sympathetic portrayals of both Arabs and Muslims. And usually Arabs and Muslims are conflated, so there's no real distinction in the US media. But I saw an increase in sympathetic portrayals. And what I mean by sympathetic portrayals is that in the history of Hollywood filmmaking, so if we go back to Back to the Future, we are happy when the enemy is killed. He's the bad guy, and we are rejoicing that the enemy's dead. And after 9/11, there were opportunities to feel really bad for Muslims who were the victims of hate crimes, or to sympathize with the CIA agent who's Muslim, who's working hard against terrorism. And so there were multiple opportunities to feel sympathetic for Arab and Muslim characters on US television. And I was, and this doesn't mean that they were all sympathetic. There was still an increase in terrorist storylines and an increase in terrorist characters. But alongside that, there was an increase in these sympathetic, and I'll put in quotation marks, positive representations. And so I was curious about how, on the one hand, there were more positive portrayals, and on the other hand, there was an increase in hate crimes, workplace discrimination, bias incidents, airline discrimination. The Patriot Act was passed. The U.S. declared war in Afghanistan and then in Iraq. And many people just that I would speak to on, you know, around on the streets, in the airplane, wherever, would say, oh, but things are better now. We're at a different moment historically. We're not interning all Muslims like we did with Japanese during World War II. We've evolved. And so I was curious about what role these portrayals had on the perception of people in the US. People kept using the term, we're at a post-race moment. Are they still using it?
Oh God, yeah, post-racial world, and it's so not a post-racial world.
At the time, it seemed like maybe it was post-racial. People were sensitive. People were trying to be inclusive in these really limiting ways. And then, wow, Obama is elected. We really are post-racial. And then look where we are now with Brexit and Trump and Muslim ban. And so a lot of my book is saying, do not be fooled. These are illusions, this post-race illusion. And so that was what inspired me to write the book. And I found, basically, I started tracking what are these positive representations and what are they doing? So instead of, is it good or bad? Because if we ask the question, good or bad, well, then they're good, I guess. But what meanings are they producing, and how are these positive representations operating in the larger storyline? So to give a sense of what I found, many things, but some key takeaway points is the insertion of a patriotic Arab or Muslim American character. And the patriot is usually, in the case of 24, there was a character, and I'm forgetting her name right now, who worked for CTU. Mm-hmm. Her name was, nope, I don't remember. She worked for the Central Counterterrorism Unit, and her entire function was to prove that Muslims are patriotic too and work for government agencies. There was a popular show on Showtime right after 9/11 for 2 years called Sleeper Cell. And there was a character, Darwin Al-Sayed, who was an undercover FBI agent who joined a terrorist cell undercover to prevent terrorism. More recently, Farah on Homeland plays this role. She, and in her case, her character is killed by a terrorist. So she's an Iranian Muslim hijab-wearing character, and she gets killed. And it seems to me that the purpose of this character is not to have an interesting character, but just to counteract the stereotype that writers and producers, perhaps some of them genuinely care about not perpetuating stereotypes. Others don't want the Council on American Islamic Relations or the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee on their case, claiming that they're stereotyping. So it seems like writers and producers have been using different kinds of strategies to reduce the stereotype, counteract the stereotype. So the patriotic Arab or Muslim American is the most popular one. And I track a bunch of others in the book. For example, the innocent Arab or Muslim victim to hate crimes, which draws on your sympathy and you feel terrible for this person who's going through this horrible thing. But what I notice is that a lot of these characters exist in storylines that end up justifying withholding civil rights for Arabs and Muslims.
Yeah, definitely.
So you feel terrible, but at the end, well, we're just in this emergency time and they just have to deal with it. Sorry.
Yeah, well, you've described the storyline of the siege, right, in 1998. And there's a character, the siege, have you seen the siege?
I have.
Yeah, and Sadia, have you seen it?
Yes.
So it's you know, basically it's internment camps for Arabs, right? And the that character you've described is you know, his the name, you know, the patriotic FBI CIA guy is an Arab Muslim, but he even his name is Frank Haddad. So if it's anglicized and it's Frank, he's not called Abdurrahman Haddad, he's called Frank. And
that's right.
He's depicted in the show in the film at drinking at events, and so he's kind of the acceptable face, and they throw that in, as you've said, as you've outlined there, he's thrown as a counterweight, as to look, here's the good Muslim and these are the bad guys.
Yes, part of in the book I basically say that after 9/11 this good character becomes standardized. Mm-hmm. But before 9/11, the siege is a perfect example. That was 1998. Mm-hmm. There were a few films that included that character. So 1991, there was Not Without My Daughter. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen that one, but it's a horror movie about Sally Fields, who goes, whose husband takes her back to Iran and then holds her captive there, and she won't leave without her daughter. And there's this one character who was educated in the United States who helps her leave, and he becomes the good Muslim. Mm-hmm. And then we have The Siege in 1998 and Three Kings in 1999.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So before 9/11, there were a few and they were exceptions. But then after 9/11, it seemed like if you're going to write a story about terrorism in the post 9/11 world, you have to throw in a patriot to circumvent the accusation that you're stereotyping.
Yeah. And it just sets up that binary, doesn't it, of the good Muslim versus bad Muslim trope, which we also see a lot here in the UK in the media and in film and television. Have you seen, by chance, seen the UK show Bodyguard?
I sure have.
what were your thoughts on Bodyguard when you saw that?
So the media I've been tracking try to do this. Look, we're aware and we're sensitive, but then there are some shows that and movies that don't even bother. And I think that Bodyguard, there are a few others that come to my mind. The few I was thinking about before I got on the show, American Sniper, Bodyguard, London is Falling. I don't know if you've seen London is Falling, where they are unapologetic and they don't care anymore. Mm-hmm. And I feel like these films, Argo, I would also put in that category, even though Argo has a positive Iranian character who's sympathetic and more has allegiances with the United States. But I feel like these are the ones that are reflective of Brexit, Trump era Muslim ban. So I think that a lot of the shows that I look at in my book are very much trying to prove that we're in a post-race era. And then these films, especially Bodyguard, gives the message that don't even bother being sympathetic towards the quote-unquote oppressed Muslim women. They're all bad. And if you're sympathetic, we're fools.
Yeah,
and the funny thing is, when we talk about Bodyguard, Shaft does a real deep analysis of Bodyguard in our RIS test workshops, and we've been doing them recently at universities, and we draw on your concept of simplified complex representations because, funnily enough, you've just straight out lambasted it and said they're not even trying, yet the writer and the main actress in Bodyguard, they took to the media after they were accused of, you know, this Islamophobic representation. They took to the media and said, and they defended the show and said, no, you've only watched the beginning of the series. As the series goes on, it's more multi-layered. I'm paraphrasing here, but I'm sure that multi-layered was one of the words used. It's more complex. And I laughed when I noted their responses in the media, because it reminded me instantly of your concept of simplified complex representations, where they think they're producing these complex representations, yet to Muslims like myself and Shaf and countless others, we saw that and straight away we thought, what is this?
Yes. The Honorable Woman is another one that comes to mind. where you think it's very sympathetic towards Palestinians, but at the end you realize that Palestinian can't be trusted and you're a fool to even trust the person. And here with The Bodyguard, it's the same concept where you're very sympathetic. This poor woman, I feel bad. Look, I have complex emotions. I feel bad for her. And then at the end, you're a fool.
It depicts Nadia as this oppressed terrorist woman who'd been put upon. She'd been forced to strap this bomb around her. At the end, she turns out to be the mastermind terrorist. Well, first of all, the common denominator is that she's a terrorist either way. And second of all, as you've said, the whole show, David Budd, I think the main character, he's the main protagonist. And you do feel sorry for him because he's come back from the war. He's clearly suffering from PTSD. You build up this sympathy for him. And the only mistake he makes across the whole show is that he trusted the Muslim.
Yes.
The key stat that I always see on every podcast, I am legally obliged to mention this on every podcast, and legally obliged to myself, that is, that Bodyguard fails all five criteria of the Riz test within the first 12 minutes of the first episode.
Yeah, and that's just, what's interesting is that it's a riveting show, just like all these other shows. Like, it's not about saying, oh, the writing, it sucks, but there's absolutely no awareness of impact of representations on people's lives, on people's perceptions. This is very much, to me, reflects the Brexit Trump era. Yeah. And justifies Muslim ban, justifies Brexit, and does that work?
At the time, Evelyn, just when Bodyguard, not long after it was shown on TV, there were reports on social media of Muslim women in London and places on public transport being called Nadia or being abused, abused as Nadia. And that really shocked Shaf and I.
And that shows the power of these media representations.
It does. And then when we heard that Netflix had bought the series and it was going global, again, that was quite jarring, wasn't it, Shaf?
It was. And, you know, lots of people thought that the show was poorly, it came to a poor ending when it came to the actual writing of it. I mean, you know, the absurdity of someone with a bomb being given the right just to stroll around London. Right. But then it was covered in Hasan Minhaj's show, you know, The Patriot Act.
I think I saw that episode. I don't remember it clearly, but I think I saw that episode.
Yeah, he does like a quick cutaway to the side saying, He's trying to talk about a paradoxical situation, and he said, oh, well, it's just like Netflix giving the first Muslim comedian his own show at the same time as showing the Islamophobic Bodyguard.
Yes.
I thrust my fist in the air and thinking, yes, Hasan, that's exactly what we're saying.
Yes, that's so right on.
Evelyn, for the Riz test criteria, we designed our criteria around three main themes that we felt from our research and from our own personal experience of being film and TV show fans. We felt that predominantly the biggest themes are, when it comes to Muslims and Arabs and representation, revolve around culture, terror, and gender. Mm-hmm. What do you say to that? Do you think we're starstruck to have you on the show and we admire you greatly, we've already mentioned. So we just want to know more about, do we have your approval?
Absolutely. I feel like these categories really capture the history of filmmaking and media representations. What my work tries to do is ask the question of, what happens when writers and producers try to not stereotype?
Yeah.
And what are the limits and possibilities of that?
Yeah.
So the kinds of things that I'm looking at is, do we have is the context of terrorism still there, which you have?
Yeah.
And within that context, throwing in a patriot or throwing in a victim is not really doing anything. It seems like many writers and producers think it is doing something, when I would argue that if you have the context of terrorism and you're understanding Muslims as good or bad in the context of terrorism, you're not doing anything different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, my other big question is around sympathy. Mm-hmm. And how sympathy is operating, because sympathy can be very alluring. We can think, oh, this is where we feel, so we have this complex emotion towards women. And oftentimes, actually in the media that I looked at, a lot of news reporting, would evoke sympathy for the quote unquote oppressed Muslim woman. And the effect of that was people thinking that they're very sympathetic and they feel and they have complex emotions towards the quote unquote enemy. But the flip side of that is that Muslim men don't deserve our emotion. Mm-hmm. They are bad. If they're not terrorists, and they must be anti-American, anti-Semitic, they must oppress their women. So Muslim men don't really deserve our sympathy. So a lot of the questions that I'm trying to figure out is around what happens when someone is actually trying to do something different and what are the pitfalls? Because in a sense, it shows how we think about diversity today and the limitations of that, the lack of imagination, mm-hmm. that if you think good is, well, but there's a patriotic good Muslim in there, what's the problem? It's a real lack of our imagination and says a lot about the limits of how we are thinking about diversity today.
That's so true. Speaking of doing things differently, we've been really excited. We recently spoke on our podcast to Sopan Deb, who was the culture writer of the New York Times, and he's also a stand-up comedian. I don't know if you follow Sopan.
I heard your podcast.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
Amazing. That's absolutely amazing. I hope you enjoyed listening to that.
Very much.
Yeah, so Sopan contacted us because he was really excited about the release of the Rami show. And as a result, we've got him on our podcast, etc. And we've also watched the Rami show. Shaf binge watched it, and I've watched it too. And would love to know your thoughts on the Rami show.
So I think the Rami show is so important. Now that I'm out in Los Angeles, I had the opportunity to go to a preview and hear a Q&A with Rami right before it was released. I saw like the first four episodes in that screening, and then when it was released, I also binge watched the rest of them. Mm-hmm. And I really do feel like it is a huge win for Arabs and Muslims to finally have a show like this. Mm-hmm. I also think that there's just so much pressure on a show like this to get it all right. So, you know, I've heard a lot of like bickering and criticisms, and I just feel like there's just too much pressure on it. But I think he finally has such a human and real complex portrait of what it means to be Muslim in the United States. One of the things that I've been thinking about around Rami is that a lot of the shows that came before Rami that people said, oh, finally, this one's different. For example, Master of None or The Big Sick. They were criticized because it seemed like in order to be in mainstream television or film that you had to be what Bill Maher calls a nominal Muslim, which means you're Muslim in name only, but you're not really Muslim. You have to leave your Islam behind, and it has to be completely irrelevant to you for you to be in the spotlight. So it seems like there are a few that fit that categorization, and Rami is distinct in that way. And it's not to say that, I mean, for some Muslims, their identity is just not front and center, and that's fine. But in the question of where are we going with these representations, Rami is refreshing because he's grappling with his Muslim identity. We get to see his family, where Islam means something to them. And I really appreciate that, what he's doing with his show.
My favorite character was definitely his sister, Dina. She's amazing.
She is. She really is. There's a lot of like dude bro culture with Rami, and then she really like cuts it. She really dissects it and problematizes it. And so she's a great character. And I appreciate that there was one episode devoted exclusively to her, another episode exclusively to the mother character. Mm-hmm. And I really loved the episode where he goes to Egypt and he thinks it's going to be the spiritual experience for him. And then he gets there and they're doing coke at a party. I just think a lot of Muslims can relate to
That reminded me of the novel White Teeth. I don't know if you've read it. I read it years ago when it first came out.
I have not.
It's a brilliant novel, and it's set in multicultural London, and you've got it's quite an epic novel. It's very thick, very long novel, and you've got a range of families from different backgrounds, and there's a Bengali family, and they have two boys, And one of them goes off to Bangladesh and one of them stays here. And I'm not going to give you any spoilers in case you want to read it, because I highly recommend it. It's an amazing book. But it's interesting to see how their characters develop in terms of the one who stays here and the one who goes to live in Bangladesh, the twin brothers. So I definitely recommend it. Shaf, I recommend it to you as well.
No, definitely. I think I'll have to give that a listen. I think what's interesting is the topic of comedy and representation. And we discussed this with Sopan a little bit. But something that I'd love to hear your opinion on is the role of satire in comedy and representation. I don't know if you've seen one of Riz Ahmed's early films called Four Lions.
Mm-mm.
So that it's very satirical, and the producer behind the show is a guy called Chris Morris, and he's one of the UK's most beloved satirists. The show is the film is a comedy stroke satire of how the absurdity of people being recruited to become terrorists, but it's such a complex and such a well researched movie that I'd urge you to watch. It it's really great to watch. It's really interesting. But people, the opinion is, does it fail the risk test or does it pass the risk test? It fails on a very black and white level, in that the criteria are quite clear. There's five criteria, therefore it fails because it presents Muslims as terrorists and a number of other criteria. But on a personal level, I think it passes because the spirit of the film is satirical, and it's showing the absurdity of what's going on, but also the absurdity of how people view it as well. So it's a double-sided thing. I'd love to hear what you think about that.
I agree that satire has the potential to be very powerful in challenging stereotypes. Of course, it depends on the actual film, and it sounds like the one that you're talking about that I haven't seen does that. Mm-hmm. And the reason, as you said, that it is powerful is because it can make us hyper aware of the norms. So sometimes we don't see what's right in front of us. It's so normal to us. But if you can highlight, for example, how common it is for us to see Arabs and Muslims through the lens of terrorism, and how common it is to see women through the lens of oppression and become aware of it and destabilize it, then I think that writer or producer has really accomplished a lot. Of course, comedy could also backfire and reinforce all of the norms. I think about Ahmed the Dead Terrorist, Jeff Dunham's ventriloquist act that very much reinforces all of the stereotypes we have in mind. So comedy can really go either way. But I really do think satire has the potential. And in terms of one story can't represent everyone, I teach a course called The Middle East and Hollywood Cinema. And we watch one movie per decade from the 1920s to the present. And we track the change over time. And students often ask me, okay, we now understand who Arabs and Muslims are not, because we've seen all these movies and how they're stereotyping, but then who are they?
Yeah.
And then I wonder, how am I supposed to answer this question? I can't show them a movie and say, this is who they are. You know, they're people. And it makes me realize that if I go back to Jack Shaheen's work, which I couldn't do anything that I do without Jack Shaheen's work, in Real Bad Arabs, his book, he examines around 900 movies that from the beginning of Hollywood to that book ends in 2000. And he says that out of those 900 films, he would characterize 12 as positive and 50 as neutral. So if we're talking about a whole history of filmmaking, hundreds of movies, reinforcing the same few messages, then we need that many stories to counteract it so that the terrorist one is just one of many. Mm-hmm. And so that's generally how I think about it. So Rami can't undo a century of stereotypes, but he can finally represent one story that many of us can relate to, and hopefully there will be many others.
Yeah, and that's his, like Shaf said, and you said, that's his personal story, and we're not a homogenous bunch, are we? We're so diverse and so on. I'm glad you mentioned Jack Shaheen, because we're really inspired by yourself and by Jack Shaheen. And one of the things that we read in an interview a couple of years ago was, the year before Jack Shaheen died, he noted He was asked to go to an in, to go and deliver a talk somewhere. I can't remember. I think it might have been California, actually. He was asked to deliver a talk, and he said he felt really despondent and quite depressed with how bad, how terrible Muslim representation, Arab representation was in 2016, that he didn't even have the heart to go and deliver this talk. And he said that he'd never seen it at its worst, not even around 9/11. What are your thoughts on that?
So I knew Jack Shaheen, and I actually invited him to Michigan to give a talk about a year before he passed away. And I remember he showed a video from someone's campaign that was very, very blatantly anti-Muslim. And he was very concerned about not only the movies. I mean, I think in his own work after 9/11, he came out with a book called Guilty, which looked at films right after 9/11. But in his presentation, he was really concerned about the turn in politics, because yeah. It seemed that, you know, for a while there was a semblance of sensitivity. After 9/11, President Bush kept making this distinction between friends and enemies. Who's our friend? Who's our enemy? Muslims can be our friends too. And it seemed that, you know, I think Jack Shaheen was remarking on this moment that we're in now, for lack of a better term, the Trump Brexit Muslim ban era, in which there is a turn to a more blatant form, an unapologetic form of racism, mm-hmm. whereas for the years before, it was more covert.
Yes.
It's explicit and in your face. Mm-hmm. But I think that's what Jack Shaheen was.
It's really interesting. Thank you for sharing that insight with us. It's really interesting to know that. It's really fascinating to know that you knew Jack Shaheed too, and you worked with him.
Yes, he was a wonderful mentor.
Oh, you mentioned Real Bad Arabs. What yes. other key seminal texts would you recommend for those who are interested in learning more about Muslim representation in film and TV?
So I wish there was one book that did it all, but no one book comes to mind. Real Bad Arabs it's like an encyclopedia and what's remarkable about the book, which is a resource to many of us who do this work, is that Jack Shaheen watched over 900 movies, and I asked him, did you watch these yourself? He said, yes, I watched each and every one myself, and he takes notes on them. So it's basically an encyclopedia of all these movies and Jack Shaheen's notes about how Arabs are portrayed, and by default, how Muslims are portrayed, since these are conflated identities. My two go-to books on the topic are Edward Said's Covering Islam, which he wrote, I think, in 1981 after the Iran hostage crisis, where he's looking at how the Iran hostage crisis was reported on by the Western media, and how Islam is not just reported upon, but covered, how we get to know nothing about it. And this idea of Islam promoting terrorism was front and center. And then my other go-to book is Melanie McAllister's Epic Encounters, which is about how the Middle East became meaningful to Americans. And I think that book is from 1945 until 9/11. And she looks at key political moments in which basically Americans were taught about the Middle East as this place of terror and threats. And it's a really fascinating book.
Oh, wow. Thank you for that.
That's fascinating. One of the wonderful things about running this project is that we get to speak to and meet amazing people like yourself. And, you know, I think Sadi would echo that. We kind of, it's so amazing speaking to people that we admire so much. And Evelyn, it's been an absolute pleasure. And I think you've gone into kind of complete, you know, kind of cult status with us now, because you've also met Jack Shaheen, and not only your own work, but you've met all these people. So we're huge fans of your work. There's an actor in the US in LA called Azita Ghanizada, and she's become a really great ally of ours, and she's set up the MENA Arts Advocacy, which fights for Middle East, North African, South Asian performer visibility, and she's got her own project that she creates like infographics and stats around that as well. So I'll be more than happy, if you're not already connected to her, I'm more than happy to connect you to her, because I think you're both based in close to Hollywood, so I think it'd be great for you to connect.
I would love that. I've heard of the organization, but I do not know her.
Oh, yeah. She's brilliant. She's so supportive. So if as you're listening to it, thank you so much for all of your support and everything that you've done with us so far.
Can I just say as well, Evelyn, I'm just thinking about what Shaf said, and you're a first on our podcast in the sense that we've had a producer, stroke writer, we've had comedians, we've had such a range of different people, reviewers and so on, but you're our first academic.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so I think I'm definitely starstruck more than on the other podcast. Aww. I need to pinch myself. I still can't believe you're on our podcast.
Thanks, Anya. You know, you write these books, you don't think anyone's going to read it.
Oh, no.
Anyone's going to care.
No, every single person who comes to the Success Workshop now knows who Professor Evelyn Al-Sultani is, and they all know about your concept of simplified complex representations.
Definitely. That's wonderful. Thank you.
If you're ever in the UK, please, please, please look us up. We'd love to
see you. I definitely will. For sure.
Evelyn, you've been so kind to spend this time with us. I know it's still early over there for you, so we completely appreciate that. And so, you know, we'd just like to thank you once again for spending time with us and sharing your fascinating and interesting thoughts.
Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for the important work that you're doing.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for your support. And can you tell us, had you heard about RIS-TES before we contacted you, or was it when we contacted you that you looked it up?
I learned about it when you contacted me, but since then I've seen it everywhere. You know how that happens, where you don't know about something, and then once it's planted, you see it everywhere. So
yes.
I noticed it in the New York Times. I noticed it on the website, The Conversation,
yes,
in other places that I've been telling my friends and colleagues about it.
Yeah. Again, that's another shout out to a good friend of ours, Zahra Khosrowshahi, who wrote the article in the conversation. Yeah, so she did a great job about that, and we were with her this weekend. We ran a workshop at the University of East Anglia down in Norwich in the UK, and so yeah, she organized a symposium on representation in the Middle East, and that was wonderful. So shout out to Zahra, she's a wonderful conscious of time. So once again, Evelyn, thank you so much for joining us, and we hope to stay in touch with you.
Me too. Thank you both so much. Wonderful. Bye.
Bye.